That is exactly where we are. I'm with Marie McEwen. And Marie, you know how your CV is quite intimidating. You've done all so many things in racing, written track work, you've office management, yearling sales, count, consultant, all these sorts of things. Imagine if you and I were talking in a bar and you said, and what do you do? And I said, well, I graduated the Royal Veterinary College in London and I became a veterinarian, of course, and then I trained for Robert Sangster and I trained in Italy and rode in Italy and then set up vet clinics in the United States and England and then had a lot to do in Southeast Asia and have a lot to do with the mysterious equinosis system.
I know, it's quite a intimidating CV, isn't it? And fascinating.
It would be a complete lie if I said it, but that's what Deborah Seaver has done.
Amazing.
Dr. Deborah Seaver, and she joins us. Good morning, Deborah.
Good morning.
That's a hell of a lot to cram in.
I can't believe I'm so old to have done all that. It's actually quite frightening, to tell you the truth.
And on top of all that, she's got jet lag.
Oh, well, you've just arrived, have you, Deborah?
I've been here since Saturday, but it takes a few days. But I think I'm okay during the day. I just go to sleep at 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay.
But otherwise, I'm good. I'm really excited to be here. It's been great. So really thank you to Racing Victoria for inviting me.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah. And so you're here to talk about your lameness locator.
So it's not my lameness locator. It was actually developed by the University of Missouri, Professor Kevin Keegan, an amazing veterinarian. And they've, you know, done the research over 20 years, really, with numerous grants. So it's not something, you know, I just am their ambassador, I like to think of myself. And I go around the world training people.
What does a lameness locator look like?
So actually, you know, the lameness locator is a bit of a colloquial term. It was sort of developed by one of the students, and we really sort of want to get away from the lameness locator name. So it's now called the Equinosis Q. We've done a little bit of rebranding, but most people still know it as the lameness locator. And it's a very simple set of sensors that go on the horse. You trot them up and down, and it transmits back to a PC, and it measures asymmetry between left and right in millimeters. So it's so precise, you wouldn't believe it. And repeatable, and it just puts on paper what you're seeing with your eye, basically.
And whereabouts are the sensors on the horse?
So currently we have three sensors. So one is on the head, one is on the pelvis, so midline, they have little holders, and one is on the right forelimb. And the one on the right forelimb just is telling the program when that leg is on the ground, so it knows the whole pattern and can figure out which leg is actually lame. So the one on the leg is a gyroscope, and the other two are accelerometers. And they're just measuring the distance in head height from the ground, maximum, minimum head height, and they look at the difference between left and right. And basically, above a certain threshold, any asymmetry is usually due to pain. I mean, there are a few other reasons, but for our purposes as vets and, you know, looking at racehorses, it's due to pain.
Can it pick up pain that the hand can't detect? So, you know, when your normal vet will inspect a horse and think, the horse isn't running well, there might be a problem. If they can't pick it up, will this technology pick
it up? So this works alongside your vet. It's a very sophisticated diagnostic tool. It's sort of 10 times more sensitive than the human eye. So the issue is, you know, subjectively, you don't see everything. With multiple limb lameness, it's hard to figure out what every leg is doing. And this just allows you to monitor it over time. And with racehorses, you can track them weekly and graph it and see straight away when something starts to change.
And does it pick up if it's a hind end or front end lameness?
Yes.
Or how does that sort of
work? It does both. So the charts show you a front limb lameness, and then it'll show you the components of the hind limb lameness. So it will show you the push-off and the impact. So lack of push-off compared to the opposite side of the horse. So it's showing you much more than we're actually appreciating with our eye.
So that would detect, and then you would go to your traditional methods of dealing with that. So you pick it up and then you treat it, you knowing what you're targeting.
Yeah. So the equipment is only sold to vets, and it's a diagnostic tool. So, I mean, just putting it on and trotting the horse up is the tip of the iceberg. You can do nerve blocking, which we do. It'll tell you the percentage of improvement. And, you know, so many times you see it with your eye and you're not sure whether it really has improved. You think it's only improved the first few strides. So it puts it all on paper and keeps, you know, everyone honest, and you can track it and monitor it over time.
So if we were in a stable watching a vet use this technology with a horse, the vet would have the horse trotted up and then they would read the image. And then if you needed to, say, sort of chase a certain lameness, then the vet would block and then you would trot up again and you would get...
Exactly. And it will tell you the percentage of improvement. So it'll say it's 60% improved from the last time. And you can follow what every leg is doing because if you have a multiple limb lameness, sometimes you'll block one leg and a forelimb lameness, which you think is real, actually goes away because it's the hind limb lameness causing a compensatory lameness.
Deborah, the consequence of undiagnosed hotspots can be catastrophic, and we've seen that with Cliffs of Moher, Anthony Van Dyke in the Melbourne Cup, and that caused a nightmare scenario for the Melbourne Cup, for Racing Victoria, for dealing with these horses, and amazingly detailed protocols globally about horses coming in and so on. So without stating the obvious, how important is prevention versus treatment and cure?
Prevention is everything. I mean, as you said earlier, I mean, there are going to be the cases that they're going to put their foot down the hole or make a wrong turn, and you're never going to be able to prevent those. But, you know, I think they've done studies that a lot of horses that tend to break down have some issues the 3 months leading up to the race. You know, and we can chart it over time. The ideal way to use this is after every workout, or, you know, once a month, after every workout, you graph the horses. And most horses tend to have a signature, so their pattern will stay within a limit. If something starts to change, that's when you have to follow it, and you then maybe back off a bit. You know, it's catching it before you gallop on top of a bad tendon or maybe a stress injury. You know, something you're hoping to catch it early.
And how, like, horses here get pre-trained. Quite a lot of horses get pre-trained. So they come to a trainer's stable with a month or 6 weeks work under their belt. So they're probably, a pre-trainer's probably not going to have access to this technology. So when, if a trainer's going to use this technology, when do they need to start using it in a horse's preparation?
Well, let me tell you, first of all, most of the vets in this area have the system now. I was here a month ago and went to 17 different places in Australia. They really embrace the sort of technology.
Are they a little bit ahead of the curve?
Yes, I probably would say they are. They're incredibly keen and they see the value of it. You know, the trainers are the hardest people to convince because they think we're trying to, you know, pick up every lameness and scratch every horse. And from a trainer's point of view, you don't want to stop your horses. But, you know, you have to recognize that lameness isn't, you know, the L word is there, and you have to appreciate it. And if you can pick it up early, you can do something about it before it gets worse, and you can make your horse better. You know, a horse, there will be some servicely sound lamenesses around. I mean, most horses have something, and above a certain threshold, that is okay. But you can improve on that.
Does that threshold get changed for each horse? So say, like, if you've got a horse that is a bad actioned animal but is not lame.
Okay.
Do you change that threshold within your system?
So most bad actioned horses are lame, whether you like it or not. There's a reason they have a bad action. Sometimes they can be bilaterally lame. So when they're bilaterally lame, they don't necessarily bob their heads, but they shuffle and they move badly. So the whole thing is you need to do it change over time with thoroughbreds. There's no particularly accepted threshold. We're still working on those, but change over time. So a horse will have a pattern, you know, over 6 or 7 weeks, and then something starts to change. That's what you need to look at.
Well, Maurice ridden them, worked with them, and I haven't in anywhere near that degree at all, but is it unreasonable? It may not even be the right question, but is it, because the saying in the game is every horse is a little bit lame. It's just a degree. In the context of the sport itself and managing these horses in a realistic sort of way, is it impossible to think that we can eradicate degrees of lameness in racing stock, that they just have to deal with it?
No, I mean, because, you know, you're talking about soreness sometimes after racing. You know, you're having just a little bit of generalized baseline something going on. These are athletes. You know, you have to fine tune them. It's very hard. So we have to figure out, you know, what the acceptable amount of lameness is, because, you know, obviously we wouldn't have any horses race otherwise.
I think that's the reality of it, isn't it?
It's true. But this helps you to see what's changing suddenly, or, you know, starting to creep up. You know, in my talk, I have some examples of something that was small and then starts to creep up, and you can pick it up. You know, sometimes just backing off 2 weeks, swimming the horse and doing something different will make the difference, rather than galloping and injuring it. And then, you know, the owners want to keep their horses racing for as long as they can and earn their money. So, you know, this is a really good tool for that. So
I need to ask you.
Yeah.
This stuff. Right. So I'm going to tick them off. So you rode and trained in Italy.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that.
So I actually had always wanted to be a vet. I loved horses. I'd ridden since I was a child. I hadn't actually been in racing. I did pony club stuff. Didn't get into vet school in England because it's so hard. I think I liked boys better when I was 18 and didn't work hard enough, probably.
That's not on here.
Oh, it's not on there, but I can tell you the truth about that. So my family actually had a house in Italy we used to go to in the summer. So I liked Italy.
Yep.
And I managed to get into...
And Italian boys, by the sound of things.
Well, yeah. So I managed to get into university in Italy to do vet school. But I needed to go a year early to learn the language. And walking through the park in Florence, discovered the racetrack. So before going to language school, I was working in the stables because it was very accessible. You could just get into it. You know, there was no security. So I did that. Went to vet school for a year, and at the same time, I moved stable. And after a while, I thought, you know, I think I could do this and probably improve on it, because they were feeding their horses whole oats. The hay wasn't good. You know, they just weren't doing basic things. Everything was being done the same way because their grandfathers did it in some way. You know, it's very hard to change things in racing. It's always things.
Mm. As we know. Yes, yeah. Yeah.
So I decided I would buy some horses from England. I had no money, but I decided I'd buy some horses from England. And the thing about Pisa, where I was, it's a racing village. It's amazing. It was started by the English. Everybody's crazy about racing. So my bank manager somehow managed to give me a loan to go and buy six horses. Yeah. Just, you know, just make sure that you tell me when they're going to win, you know, was what he sort of said, which was a joke.
Sounds like a good bank manager.
So you're training them in Pisa or Florence?
Pisa.
So what's the race? We know the tower leans.
But yeah. So Pisa is an amazing... It was founded by the English over 150 years ago. It's where Vincent O'Brien sent Sir Ivor before the Derby. It's a winter... training, it's sunny, it's like this during the winter, so, and it's not that far from England, so he sent his horse there before he won the Derby in England. It was a long time ago, and it's just an amazing place. It's in the middle of a forest. You don't train on the track. It's like Shanti, and you literally have to trot the horses 20 minutes to the track. You can take them to the beach, you can swim them, you know, it really changes their mentality. And I was very lucky because I needed a bloodstock agent, was in the tack shop in Newmarket, and someone suggested Peter Ragg. So Peter Ragg is the son of Harry Ragg, who was the Queen's trainer, and the brother of Jeff Ragg.
Right.
So he comes from along, and I think it was just the audacity, I was 22, of me walking into his office at his busiest time and demanding he buy me six horses for $6,000. You know, something stupid like that. So I persuaded him, and cut along.
You had a fair bit of front back in those days, didn't you?
I still do, I think. I think I talk too much. But, you know, so I bought a horse box, shipped them off to Italy, which is a 24-hour drive, basically, sold them before they get off the horse track, and the rest, they say, is history. And I think Peter Ragg saw what we did with bad horses and said, you know, it could be a niche for some of Robert Sangster's horses, because they needed to get, you know, they just needed to get the continuity of winning races and black type in the catalogue. Most people don't really care whether they win in Italy. It just has to be in the catalogue. So the first lot of horses I got were the best, you know, the best bred donkeys. They were dwarfs, they had crooked legs, but they were by Sadler's Wells, all sort of golden fleece, which was amazing at that time. And the first runner we ever had was a horse who came from Barry Hill stable. We found out they couldn't even get her out of the stable. She was trained on the lunge because she was a fiery chestnut mare. And we took her into the forest. We trotted her, we took her to the beach, and suddenly this mare is going well, and she was half sister to Argument, who was second in the Arc de Triomphe.
Wow.
We're going back a while. So to cut a long story short, we put her in a stakes race first time out just because we thought we should, and she won by 6 lengths.
That is unreal.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you bet?
No.
Did the bank manager
maybe we did.
Bet? Did you end up?
Well, that was a few years later. Oh, okay. By then. You know, and she was actually became the dam of Approach the Bench, who was quite a good stallion in England. So there you go. That's our first story.
And wow. Robert Sangster, and then you set up vet clinics in the United States. just a couple of things for me. Because he's such a mystical figure here, Robert Sangster.
Yeah.
And I think he sort of... Marie and I are probably a bit young to have experienced Robert Sangster, but he was an enormous figure with Swettenham Stud here and the Hayes Stable and so on. What was it like? What was he like, Robert Sangster, and what was he like as a client? And just the American thing that we're talking to Grace about before, there have been a lot of bad headlines at Los Alamitos and Santa Anita and so on. And you have done veterinary work in the United States.
Is
changing there.
Yeah. So, you know, Robert Sangster at that time had over 700 horses in training all over the world. He was a really big owner. So, you know, he didn't actually come to Italy to see his horses run. I think he was scared of the mafia and they probably weren't worth watching. But he did send his crew. I mean, Vincent O'Brien came out once and looked at our, you know, and... So it was amazing the people I met. I used to get horses from Tommy Stack. I used to go from Barry Hill. So I used to get them from all his big trainers. I actually got four horses from Michael Dickinson after his first year when he didn't do so well in England, got some of his horses, you know. So, you know, I was just very lucky. And we did go to Royal Ascot, to the box. We were always invited to the box. So I did meet them then. I mean, he wasn't involved the whole time. He was very fair. If you were getting good results for your horses, he wouldn't take them away. He wouldn't, you know. But, I mean, everything sort of changed with the owners, because there was the Lloyd scandal. I had mainly English owners, and that's sort of why I stepped down. They stepped down, started sending more horses to the States. So we sort of went through a natural cycle, and it was time to move on. I wanted to be a vet.
How long are you hanging around in town for?
I'm leaving either Thursday afternoon or Friday morning. Yeah.
We need rising sun. Like dinner or something, because there's so much more.
So,
we've only tipped the tip of the iceberg.
That's right.
Yeah,
we can chat for hours.
And we've got Chris Whitten waiting in the wings and Robbie Griffiths. Yeah. So we're going to have to bloody well leave it there. But this is fascinating.
Really great to talk to you.
Training horses
really nice
in a forest in Pisa and going to the beach. Yeah. I don't even know where the beach is.
I have some funny stories about my days amateur riding as well. So that's good as well.
Can you book a table at the Rising Sun? Free plug, get a free meal.
Wonderful.
Always works that way.
All right. Very nice.
Thank you very much, Deborah. And looking forward to hearing your speech as well. Thank you very much. What a fascinating individual.